Wikipedia goes dark in protest over the proposed Stop Online Piracy Act, and Apple goes to school. Welcome, everyone, to our special Friday feature in CCC's podcast series. My name is Chris Keneally, and every week, Beyond the Book speaks with the editors and reporters of Publishers Weekly for an early look at the news that editors, publishers, authors, agents, and librarians will talk about when they get back to work on Monday. Joining me on the show from Dallas is Andrew Albanese, PW's features editor. Andrew, welcome back to Beyond the Book.
Greetings, Chris.
And what takes you to the great state of Texas?
So I'm here to cover the American Library Association midwinter meeting, which is always a very fun event. And for next week's podcast, we should have a lot of interesting things to talk about coming out of the show, including the winners of the very prestigious Newbery and Caldecott Book Awards, as well as a report on the state of libraries and, of course, ebooks.
And so there could be some controversy or at least some heated discussions about all of that.
I think we'll have quite the discussion about ebooks here. And also, library budgets are under some stress. So it'll be good to get a take from the front lines here. Also in Monday's issue, we're going to have our spring announcements. The librarians always go nuts for these too, and they're great. You know, the editors at PW have assembled forthcoming lists from publishers major and minor in over 20 categories. And as you probably know, we revamped our announcement issue a little over a year ago. They now feature essays, and the editors pick top 10 lists in each of 20 categories. And I can say with confidence that there is definitely something on these lists for everyone.
Well, you know, my old grammar school primer began, A is for Apple, and I suppose the new primers that'll be out on the iPads will start the same way. A is for Apple, and that is the news out of the Guggenheim Museum.
Yeah, Apple is in the game. Lest anyone wonder, you know, where Apple's book future is headed. This week, they announced the release of iBooks 2, which is a new multimedia textbook platform, and iBooks Author, an authoring tool that's going to enable authors to create and publish ebooks. Both apps are free, and they're available immediately. Now, it remains to be seen exactly what impact this is going to have on the book business, per se, because not everyone who uses GarageBand, for example, will release records with it. But I'm really excited to see what these new apps are going to do for both textbooks and for self-published works. And we'll have more industry reaction, in Monday's issue. But, you know, for right now, I'm satisfied to be excited because I love Apple tools. And with iBooks, an author now has a soup-to-nuts solution right there for the taking. You can choose a template, or you can make up a new one, and you can drag and drop prepared materials like text and video right into a new book. And once you're done, you can push a button and it'll place it in the iBook store, which is, you know, a digital marketplace where hundreds of millions of credit card holders await. So, you know, on the commerce side, of course, there's going to be some questions about all of this and how that's all going to work. And because I've been traveling, I haven't had a chance to delve into the fine print about that. But for now, you know, suffice it to say there's going to be some bumps in the road. Amazon, for example, recently came under fire for some plagiarized works in the Kindle store. So there's probably going to be some things like that. There's, of course, going to be talk about royalties and sales channels and all that good stuff. But for a moment, let's just think good thoughts about what an Apple authoring tool might offer the world before we start thinking of all those headaches.
Right. Well, there were some dark thoughts this week with regard to the Stop Online Piracy Act, known to friends and foes as SOPA.
Yeah, so we've talked about SOPA and PIPA in the past, and it's certainly been a story that I've been covering here for some time now. But this week, was really one of the more eye-opening stories in more than 20 years in this business. You know, as you know, on Wednesday, tech firms and websites staged an internet blackout to protest these two anti-piracy bills. That would be SOPA and the Senate version, which is PIPA. And that included a range of firms like Google and Craigslist and Wikipedia and Reddit. And the response was overwhelming. You know, from front pages to home pages and TV screens, you know, it led on the nightly news. And within hours after the blackout began, as the publicity mounted, it was incredible to watch the senators and members of Congress who had been supporting these bills walking sideways away from them. Now, the fight is not over. I mean, these bills are going to be tinkered with and they're going to come back in some form. But I found this whole episode to be remarkable. In fact, historic. And it suggests two things to me. The first is that there's a new power core in Washington, D.C. You know, by way of background, both SOPA and PIPA were not the products of public input like a lot of bills are. You know, something needs to be addressed, the public brings it up, and the representative takes it forward. These were instead drafted in private, largely by the entertainment industry, and pushed forward by lobbyists, which is also how a lot of bills get done. And as you know, the entertainment industry has a long-standing and powerful presence in Washington, D.C. Well, it's clear there's a new game in town now. Last week, the tech business showed that its lobbying machine has some game. And the way it turns so many lawmakers around on these bills so quickly suggests to me that they've got some power in D.C. now. And that can be good and bad, of course. For now, the tech industry, lobby, and the public seem to be on agreement that SOPA and PIPA are bad bills. But let's see what happens when that tech industry starts flexing its lobbying muscle on behalf of, say, Facebook when it comes to the use of your private information. So, one observation is that there's a new power source in Washington, D.C., so we'll have to keep an eye on that. And the other thing this whole episode suggested to me is that I think the entertainment industry may have hurt themselves with these two bills. You know, it feels to me like they were trying to sneak a fastball by the public here, sort of couched as an anti-piracy effort, but these were way beyond that. And it's clear that the public values its internet greatly. So by provoking this kind of response with bills that were so sweeping, and frankly, I just found them to be really, really overreaching. You know, I fear that the MPAA and the RIAA, especially, have awakened a sleeping giant in the public. You know, the recording industry already has some bad profile dating back to the Napster days. But my fear is that by trying to jam these broad, overreaching, and flawed bills through Congress and exposing the process by which, you know, they put them forward, they may have set themselves back on coming back with legitimate and reasonable anti-piracy legislation. And I think we can all agree that that's very much needed.
Well, you make a couple of great points there. And while it's important to recognize that growing power of the tech industry, I think the point you make with regard to waking the public up, I mean, there's a sense sometimes in the hallowed halls that copyright is a lot of legal jawboning after a while. But in this particular case, it really came down to what mattered to people sitting in their living rooms or at their desks at home.
That's right. And I think you're going to see a lot more engagement with copyright on a personal basis in the coming years, especially as, you know, as you've mentioned before, you know, anytime you hit send on a blog post or, you know, publish on a blog post, you're creating copyrighted material. So a lot of people are now have a very personal stake in copyright.
And we think that's a good thing at Copyright Clearance Center.
And it is.
Absolutely. Thank you, as always, Andrew Albanese, reporting to us this week, though, from Dallas. So we look forward to your report next week from the ALA Midwinter Meeting. Let's turn now to Rose Fox, PW Reviews editor, who blogs at Genreville. Welcome back to Beyond the Book, Rose.
Thank you, Chris. Always a pleasure.
Well, it's good to have you join us, and you've got some fascinating titles this week.
We do. In the fiction section, we have a review of Traveler of the Century by Andres Newman. He's Argentinian. This is his English language debut, and it combines love and intrigue with serious intellectual engagement. We also review Angel Maker by Nick Harkaway. He's one of those authors who kind of straddles the mainstream fiction, genre fiction line. So his first book was reviewed as science fiction, and this one is in the fiction section. And it's an absurdist send-up of pulp story tropes and end-of-the-world scenarios. And we have a fiction Q&A with William Boyd, whose Waiting for Sunrise combines suspense with an unusual romance. In science fiction, fantasy, and horror, we review The Shape of Desire by Sharon Shin, in which a woman who loves a shapeshifter begins to suspect that he's the culprit in a recent series of murders. We also cover Exogene by T.C. McCarthy, which is an SF thriller starring a genetically engineered soldier who escapes the army even as her body begins its programmed destruction. In mystery and thriller, we have Murder at the Lanterne Rouge by Cara Black. This is her 12th Paris mystery featuring P.I. Aimé Leduc. And in romance, we have Born to Darkness by Suzanne Brockman, which is her first futuristic paranormal. She's primarily known for romantic military suspense, so this is a big change for her.
Well, it seems to me, Rose, in all those descriptions, everybody's taking a lot of different genres and kind of mixing them all up. I mean, romantic military suspense, that's a combination I would never have anticipated.
Yeah, if you look at the what Andrew was talking about, the announcements issue, actually the romance section is called Mix and Matchmake. And in both romance and science fiction, I wrote a lot about how people are combining and blending genres in inventive new ways. So it's definitely a theme this year.
Very interesting. And in the historicals this week, the settings and the backgrounds of these particular books seem to me to be sort of out of the ordinary as well.
Yeah, we have historicals popping up in a lot of different genres this week. We have a couple in mystery and thriller where we have a Q&A with Lindsay Fay, author of The Gods of Gotham, which explores the 1845 beginnings of what became the New York Police Department. And we also reviewed The Truth of All Things by Kieran Shields, and that's a debut novel set in Portland, Maine in 1892. In romance, we cover True Highland Spirit by Amanda Forrester, and that's a 14th century Highlands romance between a French knight and a formidable Scottish lady. And in comics, we have Baltimore Volume 1, The Plague Ships by Mike Mignola, Christopher Golden, and Ben Stenbeck, a portrayal of a decayed, doomed Europe after the Great War crumbles under the twin onslaughts of plague and vampires.
And to round out the review of reviews in nonfiction, there are a number of memoirs this week.
Yeah, we have Paris in Love, a memoir by Eloisa James. She's a romance novelist who uprooted her American family for a year to live in the materialist playground of Paris. We also cover How to Be Black by Baratunde Thurston. And it's a hilarious blend of razor-sharp satire and memoir, which is no surprise since he's a major columnist for The Onion as well as a stand-up comic. And we cover Memoirs of an Addicted Brain by Mark Lewis. He's a neuroscientist and an ex-junkie, and he explores how narcotics affect the brain and beguile the mind. And finally, in children's picture books, we have four pop-up books for lively interactive reading. We cover Animal Masquerade by Marianne Dubuc, which is translated from French by Yvette Guillon. It is a colorful array of animals dressed up as other animals. In children's fiction, we have five topical books for middle grade and young adult readers that are educational, fun, and inspiring winter reading. And we review Froy of the Exiles by Melina Marchetta, a fearless examination of humanity at its ugliest and most noble.
And for that review of reviews, we always thank Rose Fox, PW Reviews editor, who blogs at Jarmanville. Thanks for joining us.
Anytime.
And in Dallas, thank you, Andrew Albanese. Have a good and productive ALA midwinter meeting, and we look forward to hearing about it next week.
Thanks, Chris. Look forward to it as well.
Beyond the Book is produced by Copyright Clearance Center, a global rights broker for the world's most sought-after materials, including millions of books and ebooks, journals, newspapers, magazines, and blogs. You can follow Beyond the Book on Twitter, like us on Facebook, and subscribe to the free podcast series on iTunes or at our website, copyright.com/beyondthebook. Our engineer is Jeremy Brisky of Burst Marketing. My name is Christopher Keneally. For all of us at Copyright Clearance Center, thanks for listening to Beyond the Book.